Chapter 8. Craigie House. Cambridge was a quiet village when Longfellow went to live there in 1836. Huge trees shaded the streets, and the Charles River wound sleepily by. Henry Longfellow went about in search of rooms. After trying several places, he called on Mrs. Craigie. Her large and beautiful two-story house on Brattle Street stood far back from the road, surrounded by giant elms, and just a short walk from Harvard where he would be teaching. Mrs. Craigie at first said no to the young man looking for lodgings. She thought him a bit too merry-looking and altogether too fashionable. But when he explained that he was a professor and an author, the man who has written Outre Mer, she changed her mind and invited him in. "I've read your book," she said proudly as she led him up the carpeted staircase with its carved white banister. She showed him the two front rooms. "General George Washington once occupied these very rooms," she told him, "and Mrs. Washington served tea in the downstairs parlor." He looked out the front window and saw wide, green fields, and beyond them was the Charles River curving along. He began at once to love Craigie House and all of Cambridge. He found that his work and friends at Harvard University were as pleasant as his big, airy rooms at Craigie House. Charles Sumner was teaching in the Harvard Law School. He and Longfellow soon became close friends. Ralph Waldo Emerson was living in nearby Concord and giving lectures in Boston. Henry Longfellow often went to hear him speak, and they too became friends. Longfellow had more leisure time at Harvard than he had had at Bowdoin. He had time to write, time to read his favorite German and Italian poets, and time to remember Fanny Appleton. As soon as the Appletons returned from Switzerland, Henry Longfellow could be seen walking across the bridge to Boston to call on them. An hourly stage ran to Boston that he could ride in if he was in a hurry. Often he strolled in Boston Common with Mary and Fanny Appleton. He called at other fashionable homes in Boston, too, because the polite and gentle Mr. Longfellow was becoming very popular. But he never called so often anywhere as at the Appletons. Mr. Longfellow was becoming very much aware of one fact. He was in love with Fanny Appleton. As he sat in his room at Craigie House, thinking about her, he began to remember once more that he wanted to be a poet, that he really was a poet. "Gorgeous flowerets in the sunlight shining, blossoms flaunting in the eye of day," he began. Of course, the poem was for Fanny Appleton. When it was finished, Henry Longfellow felt as afraid to show it to her as he had felt about his first poem. He finally bought a bouquet of flowers, tucked the poem inside, and hurried across the bridge to Boston. He was going to tell Fanny that he loved her, and he was going to ask her to marry him. As soon as they were married and living in Cambridge, he would be the happiest man in the world. That was his dream, but it was not Fanny's. The beautiful Miss Fanny Appleton said no to the poet. Crushed and disappointed, Mr. Longfellow had a new kind of sorrow. He could still visit with the Appletons. He could still meet Fanny and Mary on Boston Common. But he could not marry beautiful Fanny. Perhaps she thought he wasn't important enough. Perhaps her family thought she was too young to marry. She was only 18. He wasn't going to give up. He went on teaching at Harvard, visiting with friends and neighbors in Cambridge and Boston, and writing, writing, writing in his spare time. "I hope this fine new appointment at Harvard will make you forget your silly ideas about writing," his father had said. His father was mistaken, as usual. Henry sometimes sat at his desk in Craigie House with his head in his hands, brooding, searching for words to express his feelings. Life seemed so empty, so mournful, and yet it ought not to be. Tell me not, in mournful numbers, life is but an empty dream, for the soul is dead that slumbers, and things are not what they seem. That was how his poem, A Psalm of Life, began. He worked on it long hours, verse after verse, and he knew it was a real inspiration. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. It was published in the Knickerbocker magazine, and everyone became excited about it. Young and old read it, and loved it, and memorized it. Henry Longfellow, the poet, was beginning to come into his own. He was only 31 years old, plenty of time left in which to become a successful writer. He and Nathaniel Hawthorne of Salem, Massachusetts, finally became better acquainted. They had both been too shy at Bowdoin, but one day Hawthorne wrote Longfellow at Harvard. "We were not well acquainted in college," Hawthorne wrote, "but perhaps you remember me. I have read your Outre Mer, and I think it is excellent. Have you read my book, Twice Told Tales?" "Your book is excellent. It comes from the hand of a man of genius. You are a poet at heart," Longfellow wrote back. One letter led to another, until the two important American writers were friends, visiting back and forth between Salem and Cambridge. Longfellow still corresponded with his friend George Washington Greene, who was now United States Consul at Rome, Italy. Through it all, though, Henry Longfellow was still in love with Fanny Appleton, no matter how hard he tried to forget. He had known her for more than 2 years. How to convince her? How to persuade her to marry him? In the midst of his teaching, his verse writing, his dreaming, his brooding, he had another idea. A book, a novel that would tell the story of his love for Fanny Appleton. He worked all winter on the novel, and the next summer it was published. Hyperion was its title. Those who knew Longfellow knew what the story meant the minute they read the book. The hero of the book was Henry Longfellow with a different name. The heroine of the book was Fanny Appleton with a different name. It described her exactly as she was. How tongues wagged, how people gossiped and talked. Henry's hopes ran high when he saw how successful his book was and how many copies sold. If his beautiful Fanny recognized herself when she read the book, maybe she would realize how deeply he loved her. Maybe she would change her no to yes and marry him. Miss Fanny recognized herself quickly enough. She also heard the gossip and talk that the book was causing about her. She soon made it clear to the rash Mr. Longfellow that he need not call on her again. That was the end, Longfellow knew. He had made a terrible blunder. Not long after that, his first book of poems was published. It included A Psalm of Life. At least his dream of becoming a poet was coming true. His fame was spreading as more people read his novel and verse. His family was proud of him. To his mother and his father and brothers and sisters, he was their Henry. His students at Harvard were proud of him. He was their Professor Longfellow. After his book of poems was published, young Harvard men listened more closely when Professor Longfellow talked to them about the poets of Germany and Italy. In another 2 years, a second volume of Henry Longfellow's verse came out, and his admirers rushed to buy it. In this new book were more poems that would be remembered forever. The Skeleton in Armor, The Wreck of the Hesperus, and The Village Blacksmith. How everyone loved The Village Blacksmith. Families read it around their fireplaces in the evening. School children memorized it and recited it. Under a spreading chestnut tree, the village smithy stands. The smith, a mighty man is he, with large and sinewy hands, and the muscles of his brawny arms are strong as iron bands. His hair is crisp and black and long, his face is like the tan, his brow is wet with honest sweat, he earns whate'er he can, and looks the whole world in the face, for he owes not any man. Week in, week out, from morn till night, you can hear his bellows blow. You can hear him swing his heavy sledge, with measured beat and slow, like a sexton ringing the village bell when the evening sun is low. And children coming home from school look in at the open door. They love to see the flaming forge and hear the bellows roar, and catch the burning sparks that fly like chaff from a threshing floor. He goes on Sunday to the church and sits among his boys. He hears the parson pray and preach. He hears his daughter's voice singing in the village choir, and it makes his heart rejoice. It sounds to him like her mother's voice singing in paradise. He needs must think of her once more, how in the grave she lies, and with his hard, rough hand he wipes a tear out of his eyes. Toiling, rejoicing, sorrowing, onward through life he goes. Each morning sees some task begin, each evening sees it close. Something attempted, something done, has earned a night's repose. Thanks, thanks to thee, my worthy friend, for the lesson thou hast taught. Thus at the flaming forge of life our fortunes must be wrought. Thus on its surrounding anvil shaped each burning deed and thought. Longfellow was giving more happiness to others than he could give to himself. He was still deeply unhappy about Fanny Appleton. Whenever he went to parties and meetings and listened to praises about his poetry, he thought of Miss Fanny. Other young ladies in Cambridge and Boston simply did not interest him. He began to feel tired and listless. He had been working very hard for several years, teaching and writing, and he decided that he needed a rest, a real rest away from it all. "I am planning a long vacation," he told one of his friends, "a trip to Europe." Off he went, to England and Germany, to look up old friends and meet new ones. He spent the whole summer abroad and did not come back until the late fall. As he strolled around on the deck of the ship that was bringing him back across the ocean, the sharp sea air made him feel like working again. "I ought to be doing some writing," he decided. He dreamed and mused about home. What was going on there? What were people most interested in 1842? His friends were probably still arguing about slavery. Charles Sumner had been making speeches against slavery for years. Charles Sumner, Ralph Waldo Emerson, John Greenleaf Whittier, Henry Longfellow were all opposed to slavery and wanted it abolished. "Longfellow, why don't you write some poems against slavery?" Charles Sumner often said. "Everybody reads your poetry, and you could influence a lot of people." Longfellow was too gentle to like any kind of argument, but he began to reflect. He was a Puritan. He was trained to be kindly. The mere thought of owning a person like a piece of furniture made him unhappy. As for whipping a slave. Quietly, during the long days at sea, Henry Longfellow began to write a set of poems on slavery, 7 in all. When he reached home and published his poems on slavery, his friends were surprised. "I never expected you to write anything political," said Hawthorne. "Oh, I'm not getting into politics," said Longfellow. "I really wrote them because I felt disturbed about slavery, and to please Charles Sumner." He was home. He felt rested. He was busy working again. But the lonely professor was still in love with Fanny Appleton. Practically everyone in Cambridge and Boston and Portland knew why the handsome, stylishly dressed poet looked so mournful at times. It was because of that indifferent young Boston lady. By now she was 24, and she seemed to grow more beautiful every year. "I am really tired of this," said a Cambridge lady one day. "Henry Longfellow and Fanny Appleton would make an ideal couple. I am going to arrange it." So the lady gave a party on a warm April evening when the windows of her large, lovely house could be opened to the garden. She invited dozens of persons, and Henry Longfellow and Fanny Appleton. The poet accepted the invitation because he liked society. As he strolled from room to room, talking to this one and that, he decided it was a charming affair. He was really everyone's pet, and there was a happy little flurry whenever he stopped to talk to a group of guests. In another moment, his heart had skipped a beat. There was the beautiful Miss Fanny, sitting all by herself in a wide window seat, her long skirt spread out around her. She looked at him with her large, dark eyes and smiled. He hurried across the room and sat down beside her. No harm in sitting down and talking, surely. The Cambridge lady who was giving the party watched them out of the corner of her eye. "Well, at last," she sighed. From then on, Henry Longfellow could be seen almost every afternoon, walking across the bridge to Boston to call at the Appletons. In just a few weeks, the joyous news was out for their families and friends. Henry and Fanny were engaged. They were to be married in July. Henry wrote to his mother in Portland, "I write you one line, and only one, to tell you of the good fortune which has just come to me, namely, that I am engaged." He wrote to his father, to his sisters and brothers, to his friends on both sides of the ocean. Their wedding at Miss Fanny's home was a most fashionable affair. When Henry and Fanny Longfellow returned from their wedding trip, they moved into the whole Craigie house. Fanny's father had bought it and given it to them for a wedding present. As Fanny and Henry Longfellow walked through the big, heavy front door with its iron knocker and its key that was 7 inches long, Fanny gazed happily at the beautiful staircase. She looked through the door on her left into the parlor, and through the door on her right into the room that was to be Henry's study. "I love this house," said Fanny. "I think it is the most beautiful house in Cambridge." "We are going to spend many happy years here together," he promised her.